welcome to another episode of The Thing About Cars. I'm one of your hosts, Mickey Desai. We have a full house today around the table. Dawn, hello.
Hello, everyone.
And Dave?
I am here. Good evening. Good afternoon. Good morning.
Auf Wiedersehen. Yes. Amanda?
Yes. Hello.
Hello, Amanda. Ben?
Hey.
Ben's here. And our special guest for today is Sohan. Sohan, how are you?
Good. Hey, everyone.
Hey. But before we get to talk to Sohan about his ideas about EVs and Teslas and recreational motorsports along those lines, let's turn to Dave for our grand trivia auto question of the day. Dave, take it away.
So I have been doing some research for my next cultural collision segment, and the concept of numbers is close and dear to Dawn's heart. And so I was looking at some of the data on road trips for my segment. And question I have is who and when was the first cross-country road trip in the United States? So I'll give you four options. Was the first cross-country road trip completed by Viscount Adolf Vickers in 1889? Was it completed by Horatio Nelson Jackson in 1903? Was it completed by David Robidoux in 1916? Or was it completed by Sherman Schwartz in 1922? Would you like me to give you those options again?
Yes, please.
Your options are Viscount Adolf Vickers in 1889, Horatio Nelson Jackson in 1903, David Robidoux in 1916, or Sherman Schwartz in 1922?
Excellent question. Excellent question. And just for clarification's sake, do we mean road trip in a motorized vehicle?
Yes, road trip in a motorized vehicle, and what we would consider a car, a modern car. So okay. The first cross-country road trip.
And does it matter which country?
Sorry. Yes, we will say we'll say cross the United States.
Oh, got it. Thank you.
Got it. Okay. Excellent.
Thank would you, anyone yeah. else like to any other provisions, questions, clarifying statements?
Motorized excellent. Across the United States. Yes. Thank you, Dave. I can't wait to hear the answer to this question. Let's turn the table to Sohan. Sohan, how are you doing?
Doing well. Glad to be on the podcast.
Yeah, glad you're here. What do you do when you're not doing the podcasting thing?
Yeah, I'm currently working at Gatherly, which is a startup here in Atlanta. We started back in March, and I've been working on that full-time since about May.
Yeah, cool. I've actually seen the tool for the rest of my crew who's not seen the Gatherly.io tool. It's .io, right?
Yep.
Yeah, so it's a video conferencing utility, but it's much more different than Zoom, much more different than anything else you guys have ever used. And I just have to give you guys the shameless plug. If you haven't checked out Gatherly.io, check it out.
Hmm.
Appreciate it.
Yeah. You bet.
Just to correct, it's not only different than Zoom, it's better than Zoom. Have to brag a little bit.
It's a really cool facility. We used it for a Christmas party through Dave, and that's how I met Sohan indirectly. But you could break out. Like if I'm in this virtual conference and I need to tap Don on the shoulder and go have a private chat out in the lobby, you can actually do that in Gatherly. You can't do that in Zoom. So, it's a really cool thing to check out. But let's turn the steering wheel back to cars. You're into EVs and autonomous driving, right?
For sure. Yeah. So my first introduction to cars was watching American Top Gear, actually, because I didn't know what British Top Gear was, and that just was what was on TV. And then I was really into it. That was when I was like in middle school. And then over time, I discovered what British Top Gear was. And then I thought, wow, this is very similar to American Top Gear. And then I quickly realized I was actually the other way around. I've always been into cars, read about cars. I like driving, although I have not yet owned my first car. Also being into the technology a lot, one thing I'm kind of curious about is understanding where you all feel the future of enthusiast motoring will be. If people don't own their own cars, to drive around and go places, if they're using a shared autonomous vehicle with their neighbors or their entire neighborhood, for example, how do people like myself, on the younger end of the spectrum, fall in love with cars? Where do we learn about cars? Where do we experience the joy of driving if driving is not a regular thing you need to do? like, is driving a car going to become, you know, similar to like riding a horseback? I certainly hope not, but that's, I guess, slightly what I'm worried about, especially because I want to own a car at some point and, you know, drive.
Well, first of all, Soen, have you ever been on horseback?
I have very briefly. It was okay. Yeah.
Well, that the fact that you said, is it going to be like being on horseback? Every horse is different. I trained equestrian when I was in middle school and high school, and every single horse rides differently. So that's a funny analogy. And I'm excited about your segment because I think that I would love to be able to drive bunches of different of cars. If I had access to a utility type vehicle to do utility something, and then access to a nice little roadster to take a little road trip, or do RVing for the weekend, I actually think that ride sharing a vehicle is a really cool thing.
Yeah, I love that idea.
I mean, if I could drive a Bugatti one day and a BMW the next, and then a Beetle, that would be amazing. And I think that your generation would actually really fall in love with cars because of it.
Well, you asked one question that I kind of want to give a snarky answer to, and how does the younger generation fall in love with driving? I think that the simplest way in my snarkiest moment is to just befriend us old farts who love to drive and let us go have fun together.
Yeah, that is snarky.
Well, and you know, the other thing that when we were kids, we hung out in cars. Yeah. We talk a lot about driving and mechanics, but honestly, we just hung around cars. We were in the parking lot after school, and you know, you kind of sat around your car, and sometimes you're on your hood, and then people would go to some place to eat. And then, our lives revolved around our cars.
That's true. Cause cars were, you didn't, not having had online ability to communicate with each other, cars were a way to commune with friends away from parents, teachers in privacy. To your point, though, you know, will car enthusiasm go by the wayside? I think your horse metaphor is a perfect example. That there are still people who are horse enthusiasts and who still ride them and use them, even though we haven't needed them for over 100 years.
Ben, you've got something on your mind.
Yeah. Well, at the point where autonomous vehicles become the norm, then, you know, driving really won't have a place. So I think it'll be, you know, the way to access it will be, if you have enough money, you can join one of these places that already exists right now, these sort of automotive country club places. You know, there's one outside Atlanta that, you now have your membership fee. You can keep a vehicle there if you want. Say you don't want to, you know, really truly be a race car driver, but you'd like to pretend to be one. You can buy a little race car that, you know, is not street legal at all. You can pay a monthly fee to keep it at some place like Atlanta Motorsports Park and go drive it, you know, on the weekends. But I think that once autonomous vehicles become the norm, that's going to be driving.
For me, though, and maybe this speaks to more of the cultural change that Soen's getting at, it's like, and part of hinging upon what Dawn said is that our age range just hung around cars. Yeah, that's kind of true. But for me, it was just the experience of getting in behind the wheel of different things and actually experiencing a certain sense of freedom by driving them. And I don't just mean driving them to work. I mean getting out in the car on the interstate or on a highway somewhere and terrorizing the local children, you know, and, you know, just putting my foot in the engine as far as it will go and just cranking up the
tunes,
the Judas Priest, and just having at it, right? It just
that will be an alien concept to the generation who grows up with autonomous vehicles.
That's exactly right.
Yeah, you know, and then I'm just so lamenting when you said that. Because I want the options. I want to drive all these other vehicles, and yet I'm kind of cool with an autonomous to go from here to Savannah. I mean, 16 is the most boring drive in the world. You know, if I could just stick my feet up in the car and read a good book and, or leave my house at, you know, sometime in the morning and take a nap and then show up in Savannah in an autonomous car, I'd be happy with that. I want it all.
Definitely a convenience factor.
Yeah. I think you're doing a disservice to 16 until you've driven 70 across Kansas
or 35 in Iowa.
Yeah. I fell asleep driving across Kansas one time and woke up 4.5 hours later because I had started drift.
Oh, yeah.
My God, are you serious?
No.
I was going to say, I was about to be impressed. I'm like, I need to go do this.
There's a part of 5 in California that's about that bad, and parts of 35 in Texas, too.
I've been on that part of 5 in Cali, yeah.
Well, I've heard the urban legends about the guy who was in an RV and had never driven an RV before, and he hit cruise control thinking that was enough. And this is an urban legend that, you know, sprang out of the 80s, where he would hit the cruise control, and then he walked back into the back of the RV to get his sandwich.
Oh, yeah, I've heard about that, too.
Yeah, yeah. So, Sohan, are we answering your question? I mean, I feel like we're sort of dancing around, but what do you think? Are we anywhere on target with your answers here?
Yeah, for sure. I think that makes a lot of sense. I liked, for example, Dave's answer of like kind of specialty situations where you drive a car. So either you go to like a racetrack, or you can even imagine like, I'm sure off-roading will be around for a long time because there's no real need for someone to come and automate that because it's purely done for recreation. And also, I think like you can also already see parallels of that with like, you go and buy like a modern Tesla, right? You press a button to put in self-driving, but you can also drive the car yourself. It has a steering wheel. I doubt those will be going away for at least, you know, a good bit of time. So I think as long as enthusiasts do a good job of kind of communicating to the car industry that, hey, we still want a steering wheel. I still want to be able to drive this thing if I want to, you know, not on the boring part to your road trip, then I think, at least I hope that the option will still be there.
Yeah.
Because I don't want a future where, you know, the first car I buy doesn't have a steering wheel because there's like no other option or something.
So the question is your generation, because my brain always goes to regulation and government and laws, getting a driver's license. If you're not an enthusiast, if you're not interested in driving, it is autonomous. How do we do voter IDs and photo IDs? Like, you know, if you're not going to get a driver's license,
That's a good question. I already have like some friends that just aren't into driving. They live in a city, so they still haven't gotten their licenses. And, you know, they're in their early 20s. So for like 4 or 5 years, they just haven't decided to get one. And it raises some interesting questions because, yeah, you're right. That's kind of like a staple, right?
I mean, there are other cultural implications for a culture that has been, I mean, in a world that's been around cars. And, you know, there are definitely other countries that have different identification methodologies. But I am, you know, kind of, branches off on many things that you've brought up.
Yeah, I believe every U.S. state will still issue a state ID if you want one that just isn't a driving license.
No, you just have to take an autonomous car to get to the DMV.
Or something, yeah.
Amanda, were you trying to say something a second ago?
No, I was just chuckling along with the thoughts of that.
Got it. Cool. So, Sohan, you're into cars right now. I know you said, and I'm going to ask you some questions at the bottom of our segment that may hinge upon this, but if you were to buy a car tomorrow, what would you get?
Ooh, so either a Miata from like the early 2000s and the second answer is just because I've watched like a few like YouTube review videos of this car recently, like as in this morning, is the new Land Rover Defender. That one looks pretty nice. Yeah, I saw one drive by the other day and I thought to myself, like, wow, that's nice.
Cool. What is it about those two? Those are two very different kinds of cars.
Yeah, I definitely want a Miata at some point just because I feel like that's basically like having like a go-kart for adults. I had a go-kart when I was like in middle school and it's like the best thing ever until it kind of broke. So that would just be a lot of fun. And the Defender, I think like off-roading is something I want to get into. I've like never even been close to it before. And I also think that the new Defender just looks really nice. It's like a handsome car. Yeah.
Ben?
Oh, yeah. Well, Miata is a great choice for an enthusiast. It, you know, it's got its own racing leagues. It's been around for years and years and years. It's extremely well supported in the aftermarket. You can do about anything you want with it. I remember when they first came out in the early 90s, people kind of laughed at them. They thought it was a kind of a girly little car, but, you know, it has really proven its worth. It was inspired by, you know, a lot of British sports cars from the classic era. So, you know, as long as you're not obnoxiously tall, you can't go wrong with it.
If Misty were here, she'd be singing the praises of the car. She's got an X5 that she says she likes to take on the Autobahn. And what did she say? Do you guys remember 170 kilometers per hour on the Autobahn so far?
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah.
It's a good clip.
Yeah. The car's name is Colette.
Colette.
So don't get the Land Rover unless you've got deep pockets.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah,
that's fair. Yeah,
I've heard that they are a bit demanding on the upkeep. and the reliability suffers after a few years.
Right.
For sure.
That's right. Anything else on your mind, Sohan, regarding electric cars, EVs, or auto? What am I? I can't talk all of a sudden. Maybe I'm having a TIA or something.
I was wondering if any of you have like strong opinions on electric cars, like love them, hate them, see them as like kind of a necessity, like eventually, like anyone have like a hot take there?
Well, it's a different thing. I think for the true, you know, good old fashioned motoring enthusiast, getting used to not having the combustion engine, you know, will be a little bit of a test, but that blistering instant torque is great. You know, the green aspect is great. I mean, I'm one of the few gearheads who has a degree in environmental science. So, you know, I see both sides of this. And, you know, of course, I always find ways to plug my project, but I've got a 1970 Lotus that I've been fixing up. Great old-fashioned dyed-in-the-wool sports car with a manual gearbox and oil leaks and all that jazz. But, you know, and it's got a freshly rebuilt engine in it. But I've already decided that when that engine wears out, when it's time to rebuild it again, which will probably be about 80,000 miles or God knows how many years, I'm going to convert it to electric. It's a very lightweight car that handles well. So it's a great candidate for this sort of thing. And some other people are already doing it with, you know, the same or similar models. And it works pretty well. You know, the technology is still pretty young. It's still kind of a wild west as far as adapting what will fit and what will work. But, you know, there's huge potential for, you know, the motoring enthusiast, the kind of person who wants to get their knuckles dirty to do these electric projects. They're fascinating. I've seen conversions of everything from MGs to like an 82 Toyota pickup. You know, if you have a big old American car, you got more room for batteries.
Yeah, batteries are always the question.
Yeah. When I, and that very first time I came on the show, this was actually one of the issues I brought up, because we had a hybrid. I have no problem with it. The torque is awesome. They're just, so many of them are boring sedan cars.
Yeah.
And in my case, you know, I've been driving convertibles since I was 26 years old. I really like having the top down, you know, and the first time I came on the show, I was like, when's somebody going to build something that's really fun, interesting, and different? That there has been a move away from interesting cars for a lot of our lifetime into much more generic, common look, you know, similar looking, similar functionality type cars.
Yeah.
I'm really, you know, probably going down the same path Ben is for my next car, or even possibly for my current one, is to have it converted to electric as the battery technology gets better.
Yeah, I'm definitely, the CLK is going to go electric. There's no doubt. I'm not putting another engine in that car when it goes.
Also, electric is the fastest growing segment right now in drag racing. It's really cool to watch. Really? Yeah, you can find this on YouTube. Yeah. You can find some drag runs where it's a gas car versus an electric car. They're so funny to watch because, you know, the gas car makes all this noise, all this sound and fury and Sturm und Drang, all this flame and smoke and, you know, ear splitting volume and just like, you know, the sound of like, you know, hell itself opening up. Meanwhile, the electric car just goes and disappears at the far end of the track.
Interesting.
You're leaving the gas car behind and it's fits and flames.
Right. Yeah. And I, you know, just to wrap that up, that thought is that I love the idea of innovation. I love the idea that new technologies are making it possible for folks to have fun, but the nature of that fun is going to change, right? Like Ben said, you know, with a fuel dragster, it is fire and brimstone at one end of that car, that lags for a second before you get into the raw speed element. And the whole culture around that is going to have to embrace the idea that a very silent car with a very high-pitched whine is going to outperform that gas guzzler dragster.
Well, and even just for a nice drive in the countryside or motorcycle ride too, because those are going electric as well. The silence is a great thing. You know, roll down your windows or open the face shield on your helmet and just take in, you know, just take in the nothing, or the, you know, if your motor isn't too whiny, you know, maybe you'll hear the birds chirping or something.
Yeah, that's a good point, Ben. And you know, we've only had cars for 130 years of the world history. Yeah. I think Sohan, you hit it. It's like we had horses, now we have cars. What's next?
And think about when you're out in a natural park or national park or natural area somewhere, you're hiking, you think you're miles from civilization, and you hear some open pipe Harley echoing two mountains away, you know, just imagine that going away.
I was going to say again, and I'm not being serious here, but I like being able to hit the throttle and scaring nuns in the distance, you know? So anyway, Dave's like, again, rethinking his life choices here.
Periodically, yes. Yeah. But, yeah. You're in an odd place this weekend.
I am. I crack myself up. That's the fun part of this. But anyway, what else is on your mind, Sean?
Honestly, that's pretty much it that I can think of right now. I really like the point about like retrofitting kind of more classic cars, because I agree, like modern car design, partially because of safety, partially because of, you know, conformity, they all look very similar and, you know, generally more boring. So even if I look at, you know, like cars from like the 80s that were, you know, were around before I was, like, those are the type of cars that I would want to drive, you know, but not have to think about, you know, being an apt mechanic to like take care of them, right? Yeah. Or know how to like fix them when they break down. Yeah. So without learning that skill set, I think having like a retrofitted classic car would be like, yeah, my ideal kind of dream car at this stage. So I really resonate with what you all said.
Have you seen the documentary Who Killed the Electric Car?
Nope.
Has anyone else at the table seen this documentary?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
It's an interesting watch, and I mean it's almost out of date anymore just because of the prevalence of the electric cars coming back into the market. But there was an interesting story. GM actually came out with an electric car back in the 80s, was it, or early 90s? And
it was early 2000s, I think.
Was it? Was it that recent?
It was about 2001 or two. It was the EV1, and it's interesting. But yeah, and these things, they were almost designed to prove that it wasn't a good idea, because they were, you know, they were leased to a small number of customers on the West Coast who paid $34,000 a year to drive these things. They were, you know, fairly impractical, but despite all that, the people who had them loved them. When GM took them all back, you know, they refused to renew all the leases. They destroyed most of them. A handful have been survived in disabled condition that are in museums now. And interestingly, the drive unit for an EV1 came up on Craigslist recently, because the thing was, dealers had to have parts to support them. So some dealer somewhere had the motor and gear drive unit collecting dust on a shelf, and it came up on Craigslist fairly recently. The guy selling it got it from the dealer. He was going to put it in an old VW Golf, but then he lost interest in the project. And there is a sequel out now, I think, called The Revenge of the Electric Car that I have not seen yet. Yeah.
Well, to anyone who hasn't watched it, I recommend the documentary. It's an interesting look at a certain segment of motoring fandom, I guess, and a little bit of political history involved in there as well. But it's an interesting thing to watch. So so thank you, Sohan. This is good stuff. We always wrap out the guest segment with four questions. You ready for your four questions?
Let's do it.
All right. Question number one, what is your dream car?
Right now, it's actually the Tesla Cybertruck, which is probably a polarizing I think it looks sick.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah.
That's cool. Question number two, where's your next road trip?
Ooh, I want to take a cross-country road trip. So like drive out all the way from Atlanta to SF. That'd be great.
Awesome. Great. Yeah. Anything along the way that you want to be sure and catch while you're out there?
Ideally some like national parks, but like, I don't know if Yellowstone's along the way, but I went to Yellowstone when I was like really young, like 10 years old. And it was like great experience. I'd love to go back there.
It's your road trip. Absolutely. The whole country is along the way.
Yeah.
That's what I was about to say.
Yeah. Question number three, what's the most fascinating thing you've seen in someone's house or garage?
Ooh, that's a good question. I went to a professor's house actually for like a dinner. This is like my freshman year of college. And he had a Porsche Boxster that I think he still owns it. That was signed by like one of Porsche's most famous test drivers. I thought that was pretty cool. It was exciting. Oh,
nice.
That's kind of cool.
That is kind of cool. Question number four is always something whimsical and silly. If you were arrested with no explanation, what would your friends and family assume that you had done?
Ooh, it's a good question. Probably shoplifting something very minor. Yeah. It's like, let me shoplift a souvenir or something. Yeah. For the record, if my parents are listening, I would not do that ever.
Disclaimer, love it.
Yeah. I don't know what I would say as my own answer to that question. That's the hard part. It could be.
Oh, I think probably if you were arrested, I'd assume you'd beaten a nun.
Run over one.
Sure. Oh my.
For the record, I have nothing against nuns.
It's been a theme in three shows now.
It's funny.
Oh my. I'm sorry I missed that one. Wow.
I'm the one who spent 12 years in Catholic school and you're the one with nun issues.
They're sharpening their rulers right now.
Wow.
It's true. I do have nun issues.
Swapping hands.
I only spent 7 years in Catholic school. Okay. Well, this is now, okay. We got to go offline now.
I went to, we'll have that conversation later. I did spend 1 year in Catholic school as a first grader. But in any case, thank you, Sohan. We hope you'll stick around for the rest of the show and chime in on the rest of the discussion.
I will do. Thanks for having me.
You bet. Thank you. Let's shift gears now and turn to Dawn on the Audubon. Dawn, what have you done?
Hey, everybody. I am in my numbers space. I am a numbers person. I love numbers. I think they have a lot of symbology. And I've always thought that the numbers in my life really correspond to my love for cars. I was born in 66, so Route 66, been on it several times. I think that's a fun number. I just turned 55 this weekend. And so finally, I can drive the speed limit. I don't know whether I'm saying that up or down, but one of my vehicles has pi on the license plate. And I was thinking about just how numbers and cars go hand in hand. It's like, you know, things are in increments of five. They're, we've set speed limits at 55, 45, 35, whatever, 75. We have calipers and, everything that's measured is in either in tens or, increments of five. And I don't know, just numbers and cars seems to be interesting. When I'm driving, I'm always thinking about when am I going to get to that next, 25 miles? You know, what's between here and the next 25 miles, or how that kind of syncs up. And so the numerology, I just thought I'd throw that out there and see, are there numbers that you guys think are in corresponding with the vehicles?
Amanda, what do you think?
I don't know that I've ever really put a lot of thought into it. About the only number related thing I do related to my vehicle is when I pump gas, I always finish off my tank with a 5 or a 0 when I fill up. And that way I always know that a transaction at the gas station on my debit card or whatever is when I pump it.
Right.
Wow, because that's been my habit for years. And I actually got a call from my bank one time saying, did you pump gas in Seattle or something? And I was like, nope, never been to Seattle. And they said, well, can we confirm this transaction amount? I'm like, sure. And they said, well, it's a pay at the pump for, $62.13 or something. And I said, nope, definitely not me. And that's the only time I've ever really used it, but it worked out perfectly.
That's an intro. I have never thought of doing that, Amanda, I perseverate on numbers. I love numbers. I love statistics, but what a great suggestion to people. I think that's a really neat idea.
And it's funny, before you specified that it was on the purchase amount, my first thought was, well, okay, is it on the purchase amount or the liquid amount? The reason I say that is because I saw a funny picture somewhere where it was, someone had pumped like a number of gallons that ended in 000 and their purchase price had ended in 99. And the caption was OCD nightmare.
Right. Which I can completely understand, because that's really kind of how it started out for me, was that I just was trying to be a little OCD. And so I would pump to a 0 or a 5 as the end number just purposefully because of that. But it's become such a routine now that it's actually protected me a couple of times. So, And it's helpful. Like if you're looking at your bank statement, you can go, I don't remember going to Quick Trip and spending $2.13, and you can kind of think back and figure out what a purchase was that way too.
So on, do you do the numbers thing? Are there significant numbers to you?
I honestly can't think of one. The only one that I guess I do sometimes when I'm driving, and this is like very cliche, is there's just like this ramp near where I live onto a highway. And you have to like, there's pretty much a stop sign, and then you have to go and join the merge onto the highway. It's like a 2-lane highway, so you have to like speed up pretty quickly. So I will speed up like, you know, usually a bit too fast, but like right up to 60. And then, you know, I'll just try to see like how quickly I can get to 60. Just because, you know, 0 to 60 is so ingrained. I've never like timed myself or anything. But yeah, that's the only thing I can do that really comes to mind.
Ben? Well, you know, from an engineering standpoint, cars are full of numbers.
Yes.
Every gear in your transmission is a ratio. You know, it's number of turns on the input shaft versus the number of turns on the output shaft. And when I'm working on older cars mostly, then newer ones not so much, but with older ones, you have to do valve adjustments periodically. So you're measuring a little clearance. You're sticking a little strip of metal, they call it a feeler gauge, into a tight space. You're measuring what that space is, and there's a tolerance that space has to be. If it's too big or too small, you make an adjustment. And in the case of a lot of older cars, you make that adjustment by changing out a shim, which means, okay, you write down the number you measured, you do some math and figure out what it needs to be. Then you pull out the shim, measure it with a micrometer, do a little math and figure out whether your shim needs to be a little bigger or a little smaller and by how many thousandths of an inch. And you can't do it all in your head. You've got to either write it down or use a spreadsheet, or you'll forget what you're doing and get lost. I've seen some cool spreadsheets some people have made at home that do the figuring for you. One of them even accounted for the thickness of the oil sealant that went between the cam housing and the cylinder head on one particular engine. So pretty cool stuff.
That's a great point, Ben. And we do. We have a lot of numbers that are associated, because I think in a lot of ways cars are about math. It's like that universal language. Math is what we all can agree on. There's no wiggle room there. It is what it is.
Yeah. Transmission isn't the only ratio either. The steering is a ratio, number of turns of the steering wheel versus how many degrees of front wheel turn. The diameter of the tire affects how the speedometer reads, things like that. Even with the hydraulic systems, for instance, with the brakes, you know, you have a master cylinder and it's probably not very PC now, but the slave cylinder at the other end, the one you're pushing the piston in one cylinder to generate hydraulic pressure that pushes a piston in the other cylinder to achieve some work. But there's ratios and proportions and things involved there. If you change the diameter of one of these cylinders but not the other one, then you suddenly have a different amount of travel and a different amount of resistance to do the work. And you can do all kinds of interesting mathematical slicing and dicing on this stuff.
Well, are we talking about math or engineering or OCD and superstition, Dawn?
I think we're talking about all of it.
Okay.
Because, you know, like,
I'd be surprised how much OCD and engineering go hand in hand.
Oh, yeah.
Because I'll give you an example. You know, when they changed all the roads to be the exit for the miles to the end of the state, you know, like we used to have the numbers of the exits were 1 through whatever the last exit was. And when they added an exit, they had a renumber. And then someone said, oh, well, wait a minute. If we just put like how many miles till the next state, like if we're 63 miles out from Alabama, and so this is exit 63. I thought that was really cool, but I also thought, this little bit of superstition, I think in everything, I think numbers lend themselves to that. When you get to a certain point and you're like a magic number, this is what appears. And I've been thinking about that a lot. Just being 55 is such a fascinating number to be. Like, am I, where am I at in life? That's fascinating. 55. Okay.
The irrational human response to the nothing but rational, mathematical world.
Exactly. I think they go back. And again, when I couldn't believe it when I got my license plate for my SUV and it was pi, I was like, oh my God, this is so perfect. And that's not rational. It's just pi.
I should point out for the audience, we're talking about the mathematical concept of pi and not actual pastry, Autobahn.
3.14. Yes. I think there's an intersection, Mickey. I think that numbers are just can be something that based in science where we can all agree on, but they also can be very personal and very satisfying when you achieve some kind of number. And I love Amanda. I really am kind of stuck on that idea that you can use them to keep consistency in your life and measure things that otherwise would be kind of helter-skelter. Now, Amanda, I'm going to be like doing the same thing you are, and it's going to be my new OCD.
Your new safeguard.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good idea.
I think that the speed limit should be the combination of the highway number plus some base number. So, you know, the base speed limit is...
That makes sense.
Right. Start with the base number of 45 and add the highway number to that, and that's your speed limit. And
Okay, gotcha. So if you're on Route 1, you're only going, what, 46?
Yeah, I was going to say, it sucks on route to be on a Route 1.
Right.
So that's just kind of what I've been, you know, contemplating after hitting this milestone birthday. And that just, I really do for my entire life have thought about numbers and cars and how some things just are serendipitously line up and then the rest is science.
Yeah. Well, on behalf of all of us, Dawn, happy birthday. Happy 55.
Thank you.
We need to go driving.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, well, I do. Yeah. Now that's a whole nother segment, but yeah, back on the road. So I'm ready for that.
Considering that I turned 55 at the very start of the pandemic, I hope it works much better for you than it did for me as an age.
For sure. It will.
Bookending the pandemic.
Yep. Yes. Sounds like it. All right, guys, that's my thoughts today.
That's what you got. Excellent. Thank you, Dawn. I'm going to switch gears to my own segment here, grinding my gears. What grinds my gears today is when I'm driving down the road and someone in front of me or near me makes a move in their vehicle that is going to endanger my car or our cars or our lives, and I honk my horn, and then they get mad at me for honking. That never fails to just torque me off, man. I'm like, you almost killed us, and I'm the bad guy here for honking the horn? And that's what grinds my gears. So,
oh, I agree.
Yeah.
It is. It's so rude. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Dave.
No, I had a similar, I used this as an example with some students at Georgia State that I was coaching a week ago. And one of their comments was, you know, we were talking about professional feedback. And I remember a time in my career when I had moved to the South. I did. I'm not growing up here. I was not attuned to the bless your heart culture. So I thought I was doing great because my heart was getting blessed left and right. And it wasn't until about 3 or 4 years that after I was here, I'm like, realized what I had been doing wrong in my career. Because bless your heart, we're not going to tell you to your face what you suck at. That'd be rude. But we can talk about it behind your back because that's just gossip. and I equate this to, you know, blowing your horn, letting somebody know. Sometimes it's a warning, hey, I'm here. And one of the students was saying, oh, but you know, how do you give feedback to someone that they're doing something wrong, you know, without worrying about offending them? And I'm like, you don't worry about offending them, you know, because all those people who gave me no feedback in my career, you know, we thought it would be easier to let you get fired than to tell you something you didn't want to. Same thing with the horn. You know, you blow your horn at, you know, somebody, hey, I'm here. You know, I think, no, it's I didn't want to offend you. I thought it'd be easier if we just wrecked.
You know, it's the notion that you can't tell someone that they're wrong about something anymore. You know, it's offensive to make someone realize that they've made a mistake and they're not programmed to apologize and they're not programmed to actually say, oh, yeah, you're right. I made a mistake. Sorry. And that's what kills me. That's absolutely what grinds my gears.
Yeah. I mean, I've seen it a lot lately. I've seen a lot of people wrong turns, you know, wrong lane changes. I've also seen a lot of people take a lot of more risks than I saw before the pandemic.
Yeah.
We were out and about yesterday tooling around and a lot of people turning when there were oncoming cars and barely, you know, thinking that someone really was paying attention enough to put their brakes on at an intersection. And we two near misses because people are just not really being, I don't know if it's patient or not attentive. I actually did a little bit of research and understand that vehicle accidents are up now.
They are. One of the things I also attributed to is there has become something of an expectation of, at least we see this in Atlanta, an expectation of courtesy that transcends laws. And where I see this is people who will stop traffic to let somebody come out instead of, I'm being polite to the person in front of me because I can see them. Never mind, I'm being rude to 16 cars behind me.
Yes.
By, doing this one thing. And so this is, I have decided, I'm making to your point, I am perfectly at peace now with telling people they're wrong. And when somebody is sitting there, in the oncoming lane and I'm waiting to make a left turn and they stop traffic for everyone behind them to let me cut across. I actually, did this one time and somebody flew around and wiped out my car. So I'm like, I'm like, no, go follow the law. Quit being polite to me. Damn it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
That's a good one, Mickey.
Sohan, you're not driving, you don't have a car yet, but have you experienced this phenomenon in your daily life in any other way?
For sure. So while at home, I do drive like my parents' cars, like if I want to go anywhere. And one thing I've when I first got my driver's license, again, this is a complete made up story if my parents are listening, but I was thinking is that right? I got to put the disclaimer in there. But when I first got my license, I'd speed pretty often. And then over time, I think I just got more careful about it. It's not like I went through any particular experience, but I just noticed myself being within 5 or 10 of the speed limit. And then I started noticing how much other people how common it is for people to speed. Right. So if I'm ever not in the, left lane and someone's honking their horn at me and wants me to go faster, I'll be very vengeful. I'll slow down to exactly the speed limit and I'll make them overtake me. I'll just refuse to speed up to get out of their way if I'm doing close to the speed limit. So that's my kind of form of silent road rage. So I won't honk at people explicitly, but I'll just slow down and then, I'll let them kind of get over it themselves, And
that's not road rage, Sohan. That's road passive aggressive.
It really is. Yeah. That's a perfect way to put it.
Well, that's what the driver's manual said to me, the how to drive book that the Georgia Department of Vehicles put out when I was learning how to drive. Was they simply said, if someone's tailgating you, simply take your foot off the gas and slow down and let it pass. And
of course, the other side of the coin too is, when did the really long indignant horn blast become the norm?
I think we have a lot. I think that is culturally changing. Depends on where you're at in the country. Cause up north, those are big,
Well, they're here too. I've not been honked at briefly and politely by anybody down here. It's always been this, hey!
It depends on the car you're driving, though. Because, the Jeep's got a really good horn, and my Wrangler has a really good horn, and no sensitivity to it. You can't toot. You can only blare. Whereas we have a Nissan Rogue that someone cuts you off, and you lay on the horn, and it goes, hey! honest to God, it's my neighbor's car, if you cut them off, you push them in the horn, the car literally goes, you bitch.
Oh my God, I can see that.
That's fantastic.
I really and truly feel like the difference is that the focus has become so much in our society on wronging people in some way when you're driving, that the horn blowing used to be, hey, you're doing something that makes me feel unsafe and I'm letting you know. But now the horn blowing has become this whole, you're offending me kind of thing. And that's sort of changed the whole response to it, really, because we get offended at the whole long horn blow, like Ben was talking about, or the brief one even sometimes.
Yeah,
good point, Amanda.
And I think I would take the metaphor even further in that it's all about listening and speaking. And I think that our culture is a bunch of people who are talking and no one's listening. So when you have something to say, you tend to lean on the horn hard and loud, and I hope that someone gets to hear you anyway. But
that, and everybody's just a little entitled bitch these days. But this is nothing new. If you go back to the 1950s and watch that Disney cartoon about Mr. Walker and Mr. Wheeler, you'll see it there too.
Yeah. Well, that's it for my Grind My Gears segment. Thank you guys for listening and validating some of what I'm experiencing here. But let's do a little bit of listener mail. Would you rather have a listener question or a worst car story today?
Ooh, definitely a question, but also a story.
Let's let Sohan pick one or the other. Would you want to do a listener question or a worst car story or both?
Yeah, I don't want to tell another story that is definitely fake. so I'll go with the listener question.
We'd like to thank Sohan for coming and lying to us all day. Exactly.
I can't give away too much, you know, in case my parents are listening once again.
Right. All right. So our good old friend of the show, Robert Drake, asks a question. Robert asks, if you don't have AAA, what's the most effective way to find the tow truck that meets your needs?
That's a great question, because I had a Mazda 626 ruined by the wrong tow truck. It ruined the transmission because they didn't know how to load it onto the back of the loader. Wow.
I have a thought about this, but I want to hear what you guys say first. Amanda, you got any reactions or answers to this question?
I honestly can say this is something I've never experienced, simply because I've always had some sort of roadside assistance through my insurance that I've never had any problems with. And I've heard of people having vehicle issues and all that, but I've always had a
good experience with it. So. Yeah, I used my insurance, Amanda, and they sent the wrong wrecker out. They totally didn't know what they were doing, and they ended up having to pay for a brand new tranny for my 626.
I'd say the best way is know what you need and know how to ask for it. And if you don't know, find, an enthusiast group of the type of car you have, and somebody who's been there and done that will know.
Right.
And I'm assuming, that we're referring to AAA, but just talking about, because there are other roadside assistance companies. There's
Can still directly call a tow truck company and say, hey, send a truck. And in fact, I had a misadventure with this, with the Lotus again. When I moved into this house, the car was not running, so I had to have it moved to the new house. And I knew what the car needed, but the guy on the other end of the phone swore he knew better than me. And he sent a truck that, I could pick up one end of it and roll it to the new house, but couldn't get it up the steep driveway without damaging something. Luckily, I caught the whole thing before anything was damaged, and we struggled with it for a couple hours. Eventually, the guy broke out the tow straps and just dragged the thing up the driveway, and we hand-pushed it the rest of the way. But, I knew what was going to work.
Right.
And, I guess I didn't put my foot down firm enough with them about it.
Right. So, and you've never had to call a tow truck, have you?
I have not, but I do have an easy life hack to this problem.
Yeah.
Oh, cool. So if you break down on a bridge that is busy enough, sometimes you don't need AAA to come get you. So the story is like when I was like much younger, like elementary school, we were like on a family road trip and we got stuck on the Tappan Zee Bridge because in our like 2003 Honda Odyssey, like the back left tire like completely blew out. Like we probably ran over something dangerous, right? And we called AAA and they were like, yeah, we'll be there in like 45 minutes. It's on a busy bridge. It's like a traffic jam, like right behind us because we blocked one of the three lanes on the bridge. So like they had like, I think it was like kind of like state workers that like maintain the bridge. They had like a mini police force there and their own tow trucks. So one of the tow trucks came and got us. They took our van to like a nearby parking lot off of the bridge. And we went back in like the back of a cruiser. It was a scenario where you didn't actually need a tow truck if you break down in a place that's inconvenient enough for other people but expensive for you.
Yeah. There's actually a very specific and purposeful process behind that from the, I think it's NHTSA that designed the program, that there is a very purposeful process for removing any obstacles in the road from keeping traffic flowing.
Right. That's right. So I hope this answers. Yep. Sorry. Go, Amanda. Go ahead.
I actually just finished a really long and boring training class that I was required to do for my paramedic license to renew that was all about it.
Well, to answer Robert's question, I think Ben's right. It helps if you know up front what you need and can direct that scenario. I think that if you're lucky, the tow truck people who are licensed to do the towing should also know what you need. I've seen people show up and say, "Oh yeah, no, you need a flatbed, not this thing," and they'll direct that to happen. But the foolproof way is to know exactly what you need and know how to ask for it. So,
and that's an important part to that is to be responsible for knowing what you need. So if you have a vehicle that you know has to be towed a specific way or moved a specific way, you in the end do have to take that responsibility for saying, "Hey, I know that my vehicle can't be towed, say, with just the hook and drag it, you know, from point A to point B."
Right. Exactly. Thank you, Robert, for the question. I think now it's time to wrap up the episode with the answer to our grand trivia auto question. You guys ready?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Hey.
Dave, educate us, please.
Okay, so the question in front of us was, who completed the first cross-country, United States cross-country road trip, and in what year? And their choices were the Viscount Adolf Vickers in 1889, Dr. Horatio Nelson Jackson in 1903, David Robidoux in 1916, or Sherman Schwartz in 1922. So Han, since you're our guest, so Han, if that's your real name, what's your guess?
So in school, I did a project on the Model T, and I just remember the entire time just thinking, this is the first like real car, right? That was actually supported, that you can repair and everything. So I'd go with the third answer, 1916. So I think by then enough people had Model 3s. Because the biggest thing that comes to mind is like all four of those options, right? Cars were around then, but like how would they like not break down, and how would you repair them if they broke down on this long trip? That would be my guess.
Very good. Amanda, how about you? What do you say?
My guess is the first one, the very earliest date.
Viscount Adolf Vickers in 1889.
Yes.
Okay. Don, how about you?
I'm going with 1903 because I like the name Horatio.
Horatio Nelson Jackson.
Yes.
Ben, what do you say?
Yeah, I'm going with Dr. Jackson, and he had his dog along, and I'm pretty sure he drove an Oldsmobile.
Okay. Nikki, do you want to?
Wow. I was going to pick the latest answer, the latest date, only because I thought that's when we would have established roads going across the country by that time.
So you're saying Sherman Schwartz in 1922?
That's my answer.
Okay. For this one, the actual answer is Dr. Horatio Nelson Jackson in 1903.
Yay! Yay! Favorite.
He drove from San Francisco to his home in Vermont, along with a young mechanic and chauffeur named Samuel K. Crocker. And to your point, that there actually were not roads maps sufficient for this thing. The whole trip just sounds like an absolute freaking ordeal.
Yeah, I believe it took him a couple of months, and most of it was unpaved.
Right, most of it was unpaved. And I'm looking for the car. I don't believe it was an Oldsmobile. Actually, it was not an Oldsmobile.
Ah, okay.
It was my compass to get there.
Yeah, it was the car's name. He called it. He named the car the Vermont, but it was a two-cylinder car with a maximum travel speed of about 20 miles an hour.
Wow. What a road trip. That's brutal.
And on those unpaved roads, you'll mostly be going less than that.
Oh, right. My gosh. Well,
riding a horse from back to the beginning of the day.
Well, the good news is probably he didn't have any shortage of rest stops.
Yeah, and I thought I read somewhere that Tom Hanks was going to play him in a movie. I don't know if that ever got made.
They did. Ken Burns did a documentary on it. Here it is. It was a Winton. He drove cross country a used Winton with a 2-cylinder, 20 horsepower motor.
Wow. Just amazing.
Yeah.
So thank you, Sohan, for being our guest today. This has been a ton of fun. And thank you to our listener for joining us. We love your feedback. And if you have a moment, please rate us on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts or wherever you manage to catch the thing about cars. Your ratings make us more visible to more people. And we love it when you do that for us. So thank you. What else am I forgetting, you guys, before we totally round out? Any other last parting words of wisdom for our audience?
If Sohan's parents are listening, we haven't seen him. We don't know who this guy is.
We disavow any knowledge.
About anything he said. We can neither confirm nor deny.
And if you're a nun who likes to drive, please give me a call. In the meantime, thanks again for joining us for another episode of The Thing About Cars. Be safe and careful and all those other good things. And Dave,
and don't honk your horn at Mickey.
Yeah, storming.
We'll see you on another episode in about a week. Take care, everybody.
Goodbye.
Yeah.
And God bless.
Thank you for listening. This has been The Thing About Cars. We'll see you on the road.